Hello, my name is Gail Moskowitz, and you are listening to Mental Health Matters. I am a licensed clinical social worker, and I have been lucky to practice in the Richmond community for more than 31 years. Mental Health Matters is a program dedicated to issues pertaining to mental health, interpersonal relations, addiction, sex and sexuality, and discussing healthy ways in which to live a more thoughtful and emotionally honest and fulfilling life. Psychological issues are ubiquitous to all of us, and yet they're hardly misunderstood. While all of us have issues that are related to emotions, and we all have blind spots, and we all get confused, we seem to judge others, we have morally confused notions of how to make the pain go away, and we have never been able to figure out how to address man's inhumanity to man. And therein lies the show we have for you today. We have a special show for you today. My guest is Rabbi Baruch Goldstein, and he is the author of For Decades I Was Silent. Rabbi Goldstein is a survivor of Auschwitz, the infamous Nazi concentration camp in Poland. And the topic for the show is hope, survival, resilience, and faith. If you would like to call today, please, if you have a question for Rabbi Goldstein, or if you'd just like to weigh in on the subject, the number 649-9737, 649-9737. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, which comes every Thursday at 1 p.m. on WRIR 97.3 FM on your Richmond dial. You can also listen to the program in real time by logging on to WRIR's website, www.wrir.org. Once you get on our website, you can click on my show. The show will be available for you to listen to by this evening, along with all my past shows, just by logging on to my website, which you can get to through WRIR's website. Anyway, back to the show. In 1939, Baruch Goldstein was a religiously observant adolescent resident of the Jewish community of Malwa, a town that was then in East Prussia. After war broke out, the Jewish community there was relatively sheltered, and that region was incorporated into the German Reich rather than into the general government. The German-run fragment of pre-war Poland, where conditions were very harsh for everyone. However, in 1949, Rabbi Goldstein was sent to Auschwitz, where he stayed for 2.5 years. His family was scattered, all of them to their deaths, and he barely survived. We are honored to have Rabbi Goldstein with us on the show today. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, and welcome to my show. Thank you so much for coming. I'm really happy.
I'm happy to be here and to share with you experiences which I believe ought to be taught in schools. People ought to learn them so that we can learn a lesson.
Can you tell us a little bit about the experience that you had in Auschwitz and afterwards?
I was in Auschwitz from November 19 till January 1942 until January 18, 1945. That means about 2.5 years. But prior to that, I was in labor camps in the city of Malawa, my own city, and a neighboring city known as Chekhanov. I spent there about 3 months.
How old were you?
When the war started, I was 16. I was at that time a student in Warsaw. I started this in the yeshiva there in the year 1937.
For those of you who do not know, a yeshiva is a school where boys go to study, Judaic studies.
Yes.
Okay, and often a seminary.
Seminary, okay. Right, exactly.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt.
But usually yeshiva students aim to become rabbis, but not always like that. Some go to the yeshiva to just to be knowledgeable in Jewish law, Jewish behavior, Jewish history, so forth. I had no idea what I'm holding me in my life. But my father, being a religious person, he felt that every Jewish person should be knowledgeable of his religion.
So when you were in Auschwitz, were you able to adhere to your religious observance at all?
No.
No.
It came a point, although I hear and read about survivors who were able to limit their food on Passover only to matzah, no chametz. Some attempted to keep kosher, but the mitzvah compromises. It seems to me that I stopped observing kashrut when I was in the labor camp in 1941. The hunger was great, the work was hard, and I said to myself, if I want to live, I have to break this. And I argued, and I believed that God will forgive me, because you're obligated, according to Jewish law, one is obligated to keep alive. It's a requirement by Jewish law. One must not put himself in danger. And that is applied to many situations. So I remember the first time I had a piece of salami, not kosher. And that was in Chekhanov in the labor camp.
So so when you say that God requires you to save a life, the notion of you saving your life,
correct,
and eating what was available,
right,
you were starving.
That's exactly right. What it is. I've held that I'm doing the right thing, because I'm obligated to keep myself healthy and in good shape.
I want to ask you how you continued to even keep your God belief during those days.
How I could continue to observe this?
Yes.
Actually, once I did it once or twice, it was easier. I strengthened my belief that I'm okay with that.
But how did you continue to believe in God through the godlessness?
I understand. That is a good question I ask myself, too. I come from a family, a religious family, who believed, and I picked up that belief, that whatever God wants, he does, and you are still obligated to observe. I argued as much as you can. So I wasn't giving up my observance and my commitment to Jewish life, Jewish behavior, for a long time.
Did you ever question whether God continued to exist?
Yes. Must tell you that there came a time at the end of the Holocaust, towards the end, when I saw Germans taking children, babies, from the hands of their mothers and throwing them in fire. Where's God? Still, I didn't want to look at myself as a heretic, as a non-believer. I had the question, but I didn't even look for an answer, because there was no answer.
Did your family perish before they went to the camps, or did they perish
in
the camps?
Yes, my mother was taken from the ghetto in Malava in November 9th, 1941, 42. If I may add to it, this was following the Wannsee Conference. Wannsee was a town near Berlin, a resort place. They had a conference with the highest leaders of Nazi Germany. Heydrich was there, Eichmann was there, those that we know. Most of them had PhDs, highly cultured people. The agenda on that conference was only one: the final solution. These were two words to imply that this is the final solution of the Jewish problem. It was discussed, how can we get rid of Jews quicker, faster, cheaper? So the report was given that in Chełmno was a city northwest of Poland. There were Jewish prisoners, also Russian POWs. It was after Germany attacked Russia in June of 1941. They had, they took out one day, we know the date, December 8, 1941. They took out a number of prisoners there, deciding there must be a better way of getting rid of people, put them in a van, let in gas, seal tightly the van, let in gas, and after they were dead, they were driven to the woods there near Chelmno and burned. Other experiments was made with euthanasia. Euthanasia was simply people, difficult people, people who are terminally ill, young people and old people who were psychologically not well, and they practice euthanasia by killing them with gas. That was done to German people until there was an outcry by many Germans not to be done, that Hitler backed off on it. So that was, anyway, it was a experiment meant for them that worked. People were killed in a matter of half an hour or 45 minutes and painlessly. They didn't have to go through the motion of killing individuals for 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day. They found that Cyclone B was the best gas to kill people quickly.
So your mother was taken from the ghetto?
That year, after that conference, we noticed in the ghetto things became very rough, more than any time before. To mention just three facts, I'll try to make it as brief as possible. One day we were ordered in the ghetto not to go out to work, but in mid-morning ordered us to come to a place where once stood three synagogues, and the place was empty now. When I got there, together with my mother and brother, so how did my mother and brother get there, this is a story. When we got there, we saw four gallows had been built overnight. Those four people, young people, one was a friend of mine, were caught smuggling into the ghetto potatoes and bread. That is not allowed. Let the people see what is done to one who disobeys and learn a lesson. So those four people will be hung because they didn't follow the order. They broke the German law. Of course, my mother and brother and I were frozen to the ground. Yet we went home, and most of the ghetto was now in mourning. A few weeks later, only 42, they arrested all the members of the Judenrat, the Jewish Council, and the Jewish policemen within the ghetto. We didn't know why, for what. They kept them there without notifying anybody what this means. After some days, they gathered again the people in the same place where the three synagogues once stood. When we got there, there were 17 gallows had been built. And the reading was that since these leaders of the ghetto permitted to smuggling of food to continue, they will have to die and we'll have to watch it. At the proper moment, they put the people, the 17 people, on boxes, soap boxes of the soap factory there, with the rope around their neck, ordering and explaining that they will die because of that. And they did. People were selected from the group to pull the box under them, from under them, and they died within a certain amount of time. The end of that was very tragic because people started running. They couldn't watch it. Yelling, screaming, weeping. Some shooting was done. Yes, two women were caught at the same day, having baked bread from smuggled in flour. They were shot on the spot.
And it was before all of you began to become numb to the violence. I imagine that after a while, you might have become more numb to the horror of it.
Yes, we did. I'm keeping this for last because what followed was even more tragic, more painful. They arrested. They asked the new Judenrat to select 100 young people. Again, they didn't tell us what. They told us that they will be shipped for labor to Germany. However, after a few weeks, a couple of weeks, I don't know exactly how long after, they marched in 50 of the 100, ordered them to dig a grave for 50 people. Then they were taken back to the prison. A few days after that, again we gathered to the place where they dug the ditch and marched in the 50 who dug the grave, put them on one side of the grave. After that, they marched in 50, the other 50 with their hands tied to the back and placed them in the front of the grave and with the eyes not folded, not closed, and ordered them by five to be shot into the grave. One fellow moved his head. He was made to stand last. After the last one, they moved in. The other 50 had to bury them. The order included the warning. If there will be any shouting, any move on the part of the people who watched, the other 100, the other 50 will also be shot to death. So we pinched each other, saying, we hold our breath, and kept quiet. It was very hard.
I imagine it was beyond
the ghetto was then, we was in mourning. We couldn't talk to each other. We didn't know what to say to each other. It was something that I never forgot.
I wonder how you today think that there is, like how you have gotten through all these years believing there is hope for humanity after having seen that.
I don't know.
You just don't even know where it comes from.
No. That wasn't the end.
I know.
What followed is the liquidation of the whole ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
All supposedly the result of the Wannsee Conference on January 20th, 1942. The ghetto must be liquidated. We heard that other ghettos had been liquidated, but we didn't know what the result of this liquidation meant. We didn't know. Basically, we still had the idea of Germans are a highly cultured people. Isn't it so?
So you kept believing that they couldn't be
right.
This
how
inhumane.
They do worse than this, I would have already done. So the question was, will we survive or not? And as Jews, as most Jews believe, yes, we can survive. We must survive. There were others, this is what I want to correct, a misunderstanding. There were Jews, many Jews, individuals and groups of Jews who fought back. Because I was in a horror hearing people say or write, asking questions, why didn't they revolt? The wonder is that so many did revolt, but it didn't mean much because most of them were killed anyway.
I mean, how can you revolt? I mean, they were powerless.
Yes, people ran to the woods as partisans. Jews joined other partisans who already organized, the Poles or Russians. There were whole groups of Jews who joined these partisans and fought back valiantly. The Warsaw Ghetto is a good example. The Warsaw Ghetto, there were 60,000 Jews at the time in 1943, before Pesach, stood up against tanks. They held back the Germans for 6 weeks until the middle of May. They finally burned the ghetto. The Polish army withstood the Germans only 4 weeks. And these are a group of Jews who had no arms, had no trained people. Nevertheless, they. The wonder is how many did revolt. So I'm trying to tell people it is not true. We didn't go like sheep to the slaughter. Mm-hmm. That's the term used. We did not, but we didn't do the right thing either.
How?
Why?
Could, yes.
Because simply we believed the Germans, a cultured people. Who would ever believe to believe that shooting people is not good enough? They will make it faster by putting gas. It's beyond belief.
It was beyond anybody's belief that
exactly. And when we found out, it was too late.
Yes, it was.
Nevertheless, many stories of individuals risked their lives. The story about Wanda. Wanda was a Hasidic girl in Warsaw, from Hasidic family. She was a beautiful girl, and the Germans used to have treated her nicely. They called her the Mädchen with the top, the Mädchen with the lock. She had a beautiful lock. Wonder.
She had beautiful hair.
So she got herself, yes. She got herself into playing up to the guards there and killed one of the generals, one of the leaders of Nazi Germany. These things happened. Or Oswald Rufeisen. Oswald Rufeisen was a Hasidic Jew who knew German. He helped Jews until things were gotten worse. He played the role of a German and was working for a German Nazi. Until the German Nazi found out that he is a Jew. I don't remember exactly how it came to the point where he had to reveal himself that he's a Jew. He killed a few Nazis and disappeared.
May I redirect you? Do you mind? No. I just want to move in a different direction. Just what I wanted to say is that what you're talking about is that individually there were people who were able to fight back. That there was even in the midst of absolute powerlessness, there was resilience. Yes. And there was resistance. So today, I mean, you've lived all these years afterwards, and you live through that, and then you come to start a new life. Did you have hope that the world would never revisit such a horrible thing?
I wanted to hope. I chose to hope.
And that was a conscious process.
And I argued it myself. Even in 1942, my whole family, we had 45 souls, between cousins, first cousins, uncles and aunts, and the two grandmothers. Of the 45, only 3 survived. But by 42, when these kinds of killing started, all of us were still alive. And we figured, well, not all of us will survive. Some of us will survive. A false belief, yes.
But
that's what happened.
Do you have hope for humanity today? In 2011, yes. You have hope for humanity?
Yes, it took me some time. It took me some time because the first 3 years after the war, I did not believe in God. I did not believe in man. I was convinced humankind is rotten. God, how could a God sit there in heaven, watch this going on? How can I believe there is a God who is supposed to be compassionate, omnipotent, omniscient? God knows everything. How could he sit there? So there is no God with the easiest way out. When I came to America 3 years later, 1948, I happened to have met a woman who is just a superhuman being. She was a daughter of a rabbi. And of course, she was in America during that period. Also, she also suffered before she came to America, which is another story altogether. She was totally good. If you can make a comparison, this woman here is totally good. I believe it, totally. Unless you were able to hide it from me.
Rabbi Goldstein is referring to his cousin, who he is visiting in Richmond and is taking him. Who has been invited him here and is taking him to these speaking engagements. And she is a lovely, lovely woman. And Rabbi, do you believe that most human beings are want to do the right thing?
No, I did not believe that.
Do you believe that now?
As I said, yes. I started believing, meeting my wife and finding out that there are good people. Not so quickly, not so easily. I started leaning into the question of where was God. I studied, contemplated, went to lectures, theological questions, read theology, and still it took a lot of time. And I found out that believing is a matter of choice. You believe because if I say to you, I believe this is a table, I haven't said anything. Is that a matter of belief? Everybody knows something like that is a table. What we need to believe is when we have some doubts, we don't understand it. And I want to believe that this lady is a nice lady. I want you. I have no reason not to believe. I couldn't find any strong enough reason, a reasonable reason, to say there is no God. I cannot prove that. Mm-hmm. Neither can I prove there is a God. But little by little, I did find proofs. If after I was through, after I went through, I'm still humane, I love people, I love children, this is a sign there are good people and I found them. A lot of good people. This is a majority of an art, I don't know what I can tell you. And I started believing that as a Jew, I'm obligated to live. Mm-hmm. I must not let anyone disturb my life. According to Jewish law, if somebody comes to kill you, it's your right to kill him. Why? Because your blood may be more precious than somebody's blood. Or your blood is not less valuable than the other one's blood. So in certain cases, you're allowed to kill him. And then I did see, not only that, the first job I had, I didn't believe that I can do any work. My self-image was totally shot.
You were so young when you got sucked up into the war.
I was 22.
I mean, you hadn't even really gotten a chance to mature.
Right. But you see, I lost my education, formal education, between 16 and when I came was 1925, it was 24, 23. That's about 10 years that I was without formal education. I studied, learned, asked questions, attended lectures, and I found that God didn't kill the people. People killed people. Why blame it on God? I still have questions. Still the same question. How could he watch 1.5 million children who didn't sin? 6 million Jews sin, deserving to be killed. although some rabbis came up with that, which is very disturbing to me. One rabbi came up with the idea that the reason why Jewish communities in Europe were eliminated is because the Polish Jews became assimilated.
I've heard those theories before, Barukhin.
I reject this totally, completely.
I reject this too.
I knew personally hundreds of Jews, believers, good people, not only studying the Torah, but also good people. So nothing can justify the killing of people.
I agree with you, and I don't think that the death of all those people had to do with God. I think it had to do with the evil that exists inside of some people.
Yeah.
And now I do have to tell you this, which is that we're at the end of our time. And as I said, this half hour goes so quickly. And I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming and just sharing a little bit of yourself. And I want to just tell people the name of your book and let you know that it's going to be on my website. So you can certainly purchase it. You can go and figure out how to purchase it. Can they get it through Amazon? Okay, it's called Hope. Oh, no, it's called...
For Decades, I Was Silent.
For Decades, I Was Silent.
Subtitle is A Holocaust Survivor's Journey Back to Faith.
Very interesting.
Because I was raised in a very religious home, and I went to a yeshiva. There was no... It wasn't my father's style to ask questions of God. That's what it is, and we must accept it, which is wrong. We don't have to accept it. Abraham challenged God in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. You know the story?
I do, but you can't. We don't have time for you to tell me about it. But yes, it is. Abraham did challenge God. So the name of the book is For Decades I Was Silent, A Holocaust Survivor's Journey Back to Faith. And it's written by Baruch Goldstein, who has been my guest today on Mental Health Matters. I hope you'll tune in next Thursday at 1 p.m. again. And thank you all for listening. And thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure to share with you for one purpose only, with the hope that people will become better. We can be better.
I hope and pray that you're right.
I believe that every human being, Christian, Muslim, atheist, are born with two passions. A passion to do wrong, but also there's a passion, a real passion.
Don't worry, be happy now.